From SiriusXM's Doctor Radio, this is Coronavirus, everything you need to know now.
From Doctor Radio Reports, here's Dr. Mark Siegel.
Welcome back to Dr. Radio Reports, COVID-19, the pandemic, what you need to know right now. It's a very evolving or devolving situation. Well over 100,000 new cases per day over the last several days, over the last 2 weeks. And we're worried. And the hospitals are filling. And we're talking to people around the country. And it's a great honor and pleasure to have a friend of mine on today, Dr. Michael Osterholm, who is the Regents Professor McKnight Presidential Endowed Chair in Public Health. He's the director of an incredible organization called CIDRAP, Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. And Dr. Osterholm has been there for years. And what he does is pandemic preparedness. And he monitors outbreaks. And he tries to figure out the significance. He's one of the top, if not the top, epidemiologists in the United States. And it's no surprise that President-elect Biden has made him a member of his new coronavirus task force. Michael, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's good to be with you again.
Michael, what's happening in the country with COVID?
Well, we're in real trouble. I don't know how to describe it other than that this is probably the most dangerous period in public health we've had since 1918. As you laid out just now in the introduction, we're seeing exponential growth of cases. You know, it took us just 6 days to add another million cases on last week. Our hospitals, as you so well know, are basically at this point literally on the verge of collapse in terms of their ability to provide care for everyone who needs it. And we're still seeing a lot of risky behavior in our communities such that I don't see the tide turning anytime soon. This is a real challenge.
What would it take to turn the tide? Obviously, I'm going to talk to you about your thoughts on lockdowns, but before we get to that, what would you think it would take to turn the tide?
The real challenge we have right now is that people actually believing, number one, that this is real, that this is happening. And now that is starting to turn just because so many people are now involved with severe cases in their own family. And so they're starting to see that. They're now learning of people they know, they care about, who are severely ill. So that's the first thing, I think, is just the willingness to say, wow, this is for real. The second thing is, what do I do about it? You know, and I've just come up with a really simple way to look at it. It's just stop swapping air. This is how it's transmitted. And, you know, if you're going to be in close contact with someone, then it has to be someone who you're bubbled with, meaning that they're not out seeing other people or going to other events, and you're not doing that either. Then you can be together and do it safely. But, you know, if I have friends who are out eating, at restaurants or going to social get-togethers, going to funerals, weddings, et cetera, and they come to my house, you know, they very likely could bring the virus into my house. And so we have to just help people understand, you know, we're in this COVID year right now. You and I have talked about that. This is not what it was last year, and it's not hopefully going to be what it is next year. But during this time period, we just really have to create that distancing between us. And I think that's the challenge that people just don't quite yet understand. What do I need to do?
You know, I am so worried about what I'm hearing about North Dakota. Now, that's a neighboring state to you. And I'm only going to bring up North Dakota to you because I see it as a paradigm of what's gone wrong. What I understand is they were testing vigorously at the beginning. Then people stopped paying attention. They got fatigued. There's no masking. There's no distancing. There's crowds getting together. There's indoor, outdoor gatherings. And now suddenly the hospitals are full. And in fact, there's been an order to have nurses who are sick, maybe asymptomatic, but who are testing positive for COVID, go back on the wards. And of course, that's a risk of spread. So what do you think about the governor's mask mandate, which he's just put into place? What do you think it would take to turn the corner on North Dakota, which is clearly going in the wrong direction?
Well, what I fear more than anything in North Dakota is that they will start to slow down eventually when so many people have become infected that we start to develop close to that concept of herd immunity, meaning, you know, that if you have 50 to 70% of the population exposed, infected, and then develop immunity, then they're not susceptible to further transmission, you know, kind of like rods in the virus transmission reaction. That would be a very, very sad commentary to get to that point because it would mean so many more serious illness and deaths. And so I worry a lot about that this is going to happen over and over again. Now, as you know, and you know, we've talked before, one of the ways that people do take things seriously, if it's right in front of them, if it's a family member, if it's a loved one, a colleague. And again, the price you have to pay to get to that point, though, meaning how many people will be infected, hospitalized, seriously ill, and die. And right now, you know, our hospitalization is over 70,000 right now in this country for COVID. We're beginning to compromise care for all conditions. You know, people who have heart attacks, strokes, all these other things, because healthcare systems are so overwhelmed trying to deal with COVID. So I think that at this point, hospitals have to make contingency plans they've never made before. You know, they don't have plans to say, for the next 3 months, you will operate under X conditions. And that's maybe what it's going to take if we don't change our behaviors. And I worry about going into the holidays. I already know of many people who said, well, you know, it's just my family getting together for Thanksgiving. But it's three or four different families really all coming home to see mom and dad or grandpa and grandma. And you and I both know what that could mean.
The mandates work. Would a national mandate work? And if so, what should the mandate look like?
Well, I think, you know, the mandates really are all about the importance of the issue. But in the end, you know, we have so many counties out here right now that have mandates that nobody will enforce. So, I mean, the question is, what are they accomplishing? You know, I still think that they send a very strong and important message. But in some cases, we have places where the mandates appear to have some ways, I wouldn't call them backfire, but where it almost caused people to be more reticent or reluctant to even use a mask. And, you know, what we need to do is help convince people why it's so important to just take these public health precautions. And so at this point, I want to do what works. We don't have time for political theater. We don't have time for hygiene theater. You know, we have to do what works. So to me, it's how do we convince people that this is real and that there are some things that they could do. And as I've said in the last 2 weeks in the media, we're still in control of this. It's our own destiny that we control. If we limit our contact with others, as we've discussed, if we do that, we're going to do a lot to protect ourselves against getting infected.
Before I get to the larger questions, I'm asking you about neighboring states, being that you're in Minnesota. Wisconsin came to mind immediately when you said that. Wisconsin caused a lot of controversy with their mandates, mask mandates, but I mean, I'm with you on this. If they can send a message, what are your thoughts on the Wisconsin mask mandate?
Same thing you just said. I think you nailed it. I think it's, you know, sends a message. This is not about someone trying to direct you what to do any more than we make very strong statements to the point of actually, you know, enforcement issues when we're trying to evacuate people out of the ways of forest fires or hurricanes. You know, and why do you do that? Because you're trying to save life. And you're trying to do it in such a way that not only saves the life of the person, but if you have rescuers trying to go in and get them, you put those lives at risk. You know this. You're a frontline guy. We're putting healthcare workers' lives at risk every day right now by this increasing number of cases. I don't want to blame anyone here. I just want people to understand that if we continue to do this, we're just going to see more and more cases. And I don't think that from an ethical standpoint, if there's any such concept of that right now about this, but, you know, putting healthcare workers at this continued high risk is something that the public has to understand they're doing.
Mike, about a week ago, you got into some news. I'm used to that, trust me, about the idea of a temporary lockdown. And I assume you mean something like reset things, like a reset. Explain your thinking on that to me and tell me where you are now on that.
Well, I think this is a really good example of two things. And let me just say, first of all, in terms of lockdown, it's a term that I wish would disappear. Somehow we could lock it up and go away. I think, Mark, if you and I interviewed 50 people, we could get 75 different definitions for what a lockdown is, okay? And that by itself is a challenge. The second thing is that this is an example of how things are happening. You know, I was on Yahoo Finance, a website broadcast, and it came up about my op-ed piece I had in the New York Times about how we needed to pay to drive these cases down. And it was picked up by CNBC as a Biden advisor indicating a lockdown was going to happen, which was not it. Nobody ever called me. Nobody ever talked to me about it, okay? Then Business Insider picked it up from that piece, which the Wall Street Journal picked it up, and again, nobody interviewed me. I've never at any time made a recommendation to the Biden group at all about a lockdown. Wouldn't, okay, at this point. What my whole point has been all along is if we're going to have to make tough choices, like, for example, is it bars and restaurants are going to try to open our schools? I mean, we know bars and restaurants are contributing a lot of transmission right now. I have been saying for months, we have got to compensate these people. You know, the single mom waitress who has two kids who's trying to pay rent and can't when she's unemployed like that. We have these small and medium-sized business owners that are hanging on by a thread. They want to do the right thing, but, you know, there's no financial support to help them. And so what my whole message has been, and that's what it was really part of that whole New York Times piece, was that we have got to get a system in place to help people do the right thing. And I stand by that. I think that's an important issue. And so whatever measures we take to try to limit transmission, they can't be just done as some kind of, you know, we're just coming in to tell you what to do. But how do we do it in partnership with people? And how do we help them do the right thing? And that's what I still stand by. But we've got to do it quickly right now because, as you know, these case numbers are in what we call, you know, exponential growth, you know, 2 to 4 to 8 to 16 to 32. Well, when you double, you know, that number, it doesn't seem much when it's low. But when you're doubling 2,000 to 4,000 to 8,000 to 16,000, that's why we're seeing these numbers we're seeing right now. And that's what's happening. We have got to change what we're doing.
Now, let me see if I get this right. You're saying two things to me. I want to make sure I have this right. Number one, as per me, who's been through this many times, a statement you never made, they then said you walked back. Is that correct?
Exactly.
And then the second point is you're saying something I also really endorse, by the way, which is if you want to keep the schools open, you may have to close the bars. There's choices that have to be made where you find places that are spreading places. Those are the places, or risky places. Those are the places you might make a decision to close in order to keep other places open. You agree with that?
Exactly. You know, and I think that we're also asking people to be tolerant in the sense that, for example, we have a lot of outbreaks right now associated with weddings and funerals. You know what? Those are both one, a very joyous occasion, one, a very sad occasion. But, you know, bringing lots of people together and then having these major outbreaks, this is not the time. This is our COVID year. You know, you and I have talked about this before. It's not going to be like last year. It's hopefully not going to be like next year with the vaccines. But we just got to get through it at this time. And so we're trying to make reasonable kinds of recommendations that say, if we do this, this, and this, we can really limit transmission and hold it back. Because all we're trying to do is get as many people as possible to next spring to vaccines. At the same time, we're trying to spare our healthcare systems this inevitable collapse that's occurring. And, you know, my worst fear is, Mark, is we're going to start seeing people on television literally dying in emergency rooms waiting 8 to 10 hours to be seen. You know, and that's beginning to happen of people waiting that long to be seen. And it's not the fault of the hospital. They're doing the best they can. It's just they're overwhelmed.
And make no mistake about it, Mike. All you have to do is say you agree with this. It's so horrifying to me to hear that a hospital is having nurses that have COVID come back to even considering that that's the red alert.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I mean, at that point, when you're starting to do things like that, what else are you doing wrong? I mean, what could you do better? I shouldn't say wrong. What can you do better? And, you know, I understand why they're there. I mean, think about the fact that you're the one nurse in the ICU to be assigned to one bed because these patients are so sick. They're very sick. And now suddenly you're one nurse having to take care of multiple patients with some support from nurses off the general, you know, floor, even nursing students. You know, the responsibility we're putting on these healthcare workers right now is only growing. Well, how long can that last? You know, we're talking about potentially weeks and weeks and weeks of this. And at what point the whole system just starts to fall in on itself. So we've got to take these measures. You know, I've heard this from others before about how government is holding back the private sector. And, you know, I actually had somebody write me a letter about the hospitality industry of a certain state wanted to try to get the governor impeached. And it was largely around the hotels. It wasn't about the bars and restaurants. And the ironic part of it is the government's never, ever once minimized who could stay at hotels. Same thing is true with air travel. Air travel has never been restricted. Look at how far it's down right now. The point is when this virus is running willy-nilly in our communities, that has a tremendous negative impact on the economy. And so it's a win-win. This shouldn't be the economy versus COVID. It should be how do we work together to help both. When you look at places like Australia and New Zealand, all the Asian countries, but take those two because they're both democracies. When they got the virus under control, their economies came roaring. That's what we need to find ourselves in a position of win-win, not win-lose.
Speaking of Thanksgiving, what do we do?
Well, you know, I've been very clear for weeks. This is our COVID year. If you really love your family this year, you're going to spare them the risk of transmission. And even though it's very painful, you want very, very much to be with those you love, particularly if you've missed them for so long. But I can guarantee you, you're going to see a big increase in cases. You know, when Canada just went through their Thanksgiving, they had a big spike in cases associated with the Canadian Thanksgiving. And, you know, you come home to see grandpa and grandma and mom and dad, and, you know, the college student comes home or, you know, young adults come home. You know, you've got a couple kids in school. You bring them, you know, grade schools. You're sitting around all day, you know, having a wonderful time eating together. There's going to be transmission episodes in many of them. And so to me, I say this is the one year that you do whatever you can to be creative. Do virtual Thanksgivings over the internet, knowing that they're not nearly as satisfactory. You know, you cook meals for people, including your family. You drop them off at their homes outside. You know, you stay 20 feet apart. They pick it up. You wave. You know, you're close, okay? I want to spend the day for doing something I should have done a long time ago. I'm so thankful for the many wonderful people in my life. I'm going to spend all day calling up the people that I am so thankful for and just thanking them for being born. You know, that's the kind of things we have to do this Thanksgiving. And in the end, it's the greatest gift you can give your family is by not putting them at risk. And I'd rather have them around for next Thanksgiving than not.
That's beautifully said. I keep thinking if people came here from Mars and they looked down and they saw all the gatherings in our country, they'd say, there is no virus. I mean, you know, without being political, it seems like everywhere you look, there's a big gathering. Maybe people are wearing masks. Maybe they're not. They're clearly not distancing. They're saying, well, we're outdoors, we're not indoors. What do you think these gatherings, and obviously I'm talking about these rallies, pre-election rallies on the Republican side, post-election rallies, then, of course, celebrations when Joe Biden won. What are all these rallies doing and celebrations and gatherings doing?
Well, surely the indoor ones are really important in transmission. The outdoor ones have some importance because the transmission is less. But you've hit on a very important point. And, you know, and I mean, I'd ask you. I mean, you deal with a lot of this. You know the public very well. You know, you deal with them all the time. Why are we missing on this issue of the risk of these gatherings? What is it that somehow we're not communicating? And again, we're not trying to take away anybody's freedom. We're not trying to take away anybody's rights. We're just saying this is a dangerous situation right now, and this is what's happening. I mean, you know yourself from, you know, right there in New York. You know, look at the case numbers are coming back up there, and very few places in the world have done it as well as New York did from after the April event until just recently. Yet, look what's happening. Why do we not get these crowds and these groups to understand this? What are we missing?
I think some of it's fatigue, some of it is denial, some of it is politicization, you know, some of it is, well, it can't be me, some of it that the virus is invisible. And your point is right, that indoor is worse than outdoor, but I think we've really got to get a handle on all of these gatherings. We can't, some
you
of
know,
us
one,
be...
Yeah, one thing, Mark, I think that's a very interesting concept is this fatigue issue. And, you know, what people often miss is in 1918, the average time that the virus was in a community and wreaked havoc on it was only 6 to 10 weeks. And then it was gone. And, you know, for 6 to 10 weeks, just like we did earlier in the spring, you could kind of deal with it. People did deal with it. I think that no one really understood what it would mean to be in the 10th month. And I think that has created an element of pandemic fatigue that we had never prepared for and never even thought about. And that's a challenge. That's a big challenge because you would agree, even back in last March when we didn't need to basically close down a lot of counties in this country because the virus wasn't there yet, people did do it. And then they got tired of it. And I think we wasted our ability for this moment now by, you know, those earlier recommendations in terms of, you know, they could have been much more targeted to places like New York and, you know, Seattle and so forth. I don't know what you think about that, but I think that this long-term fatigue has really been a challenge that we weren't ready for.
So the answer to that and the next question at the same time is the word testing, because early on the CDC led us to believe there was a lot less of this virus than there was. Maybe they didn't realize it. When I went to the University of Nebraska Medical Center, another nearby state to you, the quarantine center, I was convinced that this virus was permeating communities and that it was being vastly underestimated. So I think we didn't. I think we needed more rapid testing early. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. And we still need more testing. I mean, I just had a personal situation, not for myself, but somebody very close to me, who got tested on a Monday in a state like ours, went to a major medical clinic, and they didn't get the result back till Saturday afternoon, the next Saturday afternoon. That's just not useful. And so I think we still have work to do on the testing issue, and I agree 100% with you how important that is. It is really very important.
Michael, what about vaccines? What do you think about all this news this week coming out about the vaccines? And maybe you could comment on the politicization of the vaccines, but first and foremost, the value of them.
Well, you know, this is ultimately our get-out-of-jail card. It is absolutely critical. And I'm encouraged by the early data we're seeing. At first, I wasn't prepared to say, kind of, I'm really, really excited about the Pfizer data. Surely having 90% efficacy is wonderful, but the question is, was it also against severe disease as much as it was just fever, cough, and chills? We didn't have those data yet, so it wasn't a criticism. I just said, I got to wait to see those data. Well, the Moderna data that came out today surely does show that there is at least initial evidence that it also reduces serious illness. Wow, that is a game changer. If we can get that and we can get the vaccine protection at the level 94%, as they said, that could have a big impact. Two issues. One is, how durable is that immunity? You know, remember all these people were evaluated for up to 2 months after their second immunization. You know, will it be good at 4 months, 10 months, 18 months? And we'll have to learn that, and we may ultimately be end up giving boosters. But I think it's really, really good news that we have so far. And I think the next challenge is going to be just getting people vaccinated. And, you know, you and I have talked about this too. You know, a vaccine is just a vaccine. It doesn't become important until it's a vaccination. And I worry that a lot of people right now are anti-vaccine here because they feel like it was done so quickly on a new vaccine platform that it's not going to be safe. And we have a lot of work to do to make way for people to get vaccinated.
Do you feel it's safe? Are you looking more towards the Oxford vaccine or even the Santa Fe Novavax? Or you think we really struck gold here?
I think all these could be gold in the end. I mean, I'm confident we're going to have multiple vaccines. And, you know, we can't get them soon enough, frankly, because it's all about production. I mean, even if we get 20 to 30 million a month out of these companies, even like for a country like the United States, you know, it could take us months and months and months because everyone needs two doses. I welcome all these other vaccines, but at least in these mRNA vaccines, both the Pfizer and Moderna, I think we have to be very excited. Now, the one thing I'm really want to make clear, though, to everyone is that these vaccines are not going to start having much impact at all till well into next year before we have any meaningful amount of vaccine. And so what we're dealing with right now, this crisis now, can't be postponed. You know, we can't just wait. The vaccine's not coming that quickly. It's coming, but not that quickly. So we still have to deal with this crisis.
And in the meantime, what are we going to do in terms of treatments?
My hat is off to the intensivists of this country. And for that matter, around the world, what they have learned since April, you know, we've seen a 60 to 70% reduction in case fatality rates among those in ICUs without a blockbuster new drug, you know, just really good medical care. They just have done heroic work. The challenge is going to be is as we now see this flooding of patients into the hospitals is who's going to be there to care for them. And, you know, an intensivist is an intensivist. They're highly trained, highly skilled, whether they're doctors, nurses, the team members, whoever. And if we don't have them, which we won't for many of the patients, they're going to have a bed, but who they get will be, you know, potentially a hospitalist, whatever. Again, you know, a well-trained clinician. But the bottom line is they're not intensivists. And so the question will be, will we still see that same lower level of mortality as the system becomes really overrun with more and more patients? And I think those numbers, I don't think are going to look nearly as good.
Couple more questions, Michael. The issue of poor communities, socioeconomically disadvantaged communities, you know that they've been at the heart of the problem in terms of COVID-19 infections and then severe outcomes. Minority communities, what can we do differently in our approach to these communities? And I guess more specifically, how can we get a vaccine? And I would have asked you yesterday about the Pfizer vaccine with 80 degrees below zero centigrade, but now the Moderna vaccine may be more of a prospect here because it doesn't have to be kept as cold.
Exactly. You know, this is such a huge issue. It's far beyond just medicine, but it's nonetheless, you're right on the mark. We got to deal with it. And, you know, we haven't. And we know the racial disparities. I mean, even if you look at just within healthcare workers, you know, over 14 healthcare workers have died from COVID-19 infection. And, you know, these frontline workers, if you look at that, there's still a disparity there among Black, Indigenous, and communities of colors in terms of populations. And so there is something very much to this issue of racial disparities. And this pandemic is highlighting it in spades. And so, you know, I don't have an answer right now. I surely think that this is going to be, though, a key issue of coming out of this pandemic. What must we do to deal with this issue?
Now, I'm going to ask you a question that sounds political, but you're going to answer it medically, which is, what is the Biden administration going to do differently? What do you foresee the future in terms of a shift in focus, and what will you hope to see as an advisor there without giving away anything to me that you don't want to?
Obviously? Well, you know, at this point, it's just way too early. I'm not avoiding the question. You know, we're just starting to meet. I am really positive on the energy that's going into this. This is a very high priority for the transition team to really put in place programs hitting the ground running, as well as what kind of messaging they can signal beforehand as to what the priorities are. So, you know, as we meet more over the next few weeks, we'll get a better sense of that. But I'm really very impressed. And as you know, I've served roles in the last five presidential administrations. We'll just call balls and strikes as I see them. And I just think that the fact that this is such a high priority for the transition team, to me, is just a good sign.
I want to ask a follow-up on that. Again, you can avoid it. It's okay, Mike. But I mean, I'm not trying to get into politics. Trust me, I'm allergic to it. But there's been some thought that maybe we need to have a more top-down approach, a more federally organized approach, because especially now, it's every state in the union has a problem. And we're in a state of national emergency, after all. You know, FEMA's involved, the National Guard is involved. It's not purely a state issue. It's the federal government is involved. And the director of the CDC said to me a couple weeks ago on this show, he said, if the CDC feels that a state is putting its citizens at harm, public health harm, then the CDC can intervene. So maybe there's a way to answer that non-politically.
Well, you know, I think, let me just say, I've talked to five governors in the last 3 days who have contacted me about all struggling to find out what the right thing to do is. They just want help. And so what we've done is we've left it kind of up to 50 different state health departments, 50 governors. And they're all welcoming input, collaboration. You know, there's nothing worse than being a governor and you're in a state surrounded by four other states and everybody has a different way to approach it. It makes a complicated message all the way around. And they just want to know, what is the best science? What is it that we can do? You know, how do we deal with these issues? So I don't even consider that political as much as I just consider it leadership and looking for that. And that's from both Democrat and Republican governors. So I think at this point, as we get into this crisis and this exponential growth of cases, our leaders at the state and local level just want clear guidance. You know, what will make a difference and what won't? How can we best implement these? And that's my sense of it right now. You know, it's just leadership.
Final thoughts about what a person can do if you're talking to one of our listeners out there. What can they do in the meantime? When is the vaccine coming? Will the vaccine solve this? What can they do while they're waiting for the vaccine? Final thoughts on that.
Well, I think the vaccines are going to be critical. But in the meantime, I've tried to distill it down to a simple message, Mark. Don't swap air. Just stop swapping air. And that means that, you know, understand what you're in a room, who you breathe in air with. Are they bubbled with you? Are they, you know, do you have your respiratory protection with you? You know, what are you doing that way? And limiting that and just seeing, even if they're your best friends, if they're your neighbors, if they're people you know. I had a minister recently contact me and was quite upset because I wouldn't just endorse the fact that he had a congregation of only 100. He said, well, I'm not one of those big 400 or 500 member churches. Why can't I just have my Sunday celebration? And I said, you know, 100 people, you got more than enough opportunity there for some major spreading events. And somehow in his mind, 100 was so different from 400 to 500. And I can understand where he's coming from. But the point of it is we just have to keep people away from swapping air with others, get to the point where we can get to these vaccines. And then one day you and I will be doing a show where we're doing a postmortem, a total postmortem, and it'll be one day to celebrate.
Amen to that. And by the way, Michael, one final thought. You know, as you were saying that, I was thinking of cycle threshold. I don't think people out there understand that as we're testing, we can kind of suggest who it is that's a super spreader by how long it takes to turn positive. We have the ability to test for things like this, and there are super spreader events. You can be mildly symptomatic and actually be a super spreader, so not swapping air.
We see a lot of those. We see a lot of those events, so... Good. Well, thank you, as always, for having me on. I always appreciate our time.
Dr. Michael Osterholm, Regents Professor, McKnight Presidential Endowed Chair in Public Health, the Director of CIDRAP, the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, author of the New York Times bestselling 2017 book, Deadliest Enemy, Our War Against Killer Germs. He's a member of President-elect Biden's coronavirus task force, the new one, the COVID-19 task force. They couldn't have picked a better person for this, Mike. It's a great honor to have you on, and
Mark,
congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Get facts, not fear, from SiriusXM's Doctor Radio, presented by the leading experts from NYU Langone Health. To learn more about Doctor Radio, including shows and schedules, go to SiriusXM.com/Doctor Radio.